Hello and welcome to The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with dancer, actor, singer, director, playwright, and author, Carol Schwide. This is a lovely and also an inspirational interview. Listening to this charming, talented, ebullient woman talk about how she discovered all of the things that she is and all of the things that she can do. Listen to Carol say she never decided to be a dancer because there was never a time in her life when she wasn't dancing. But dancing was only the beginning for Carol. Listen to how she wound up on Broadway. Listen to her story of being a gypsy. Listen to her experiences as part of the original cast of Chorus Line. Listen to her charm and her passion for life. It may just inspire you. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources, oh,
is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you need to be. Not the person they told you you had to be. Not even the person they told you you were. Actually, not even the person you may currently think you are. But the person you really are. So how is it possible for us to be someone we are not or not be who we are? As a therapist, I see over and over and over again people whose childhoods had made it impossible for them to continue some behaviors, some curiosities, some talents, some interests that were natural to them. These behaviors, curiosities, interests, talents somehow didn't go down well with their family of origin, with a teacher, with a peer group. Even religious organizations and cultural organizations can let a child know that something about he or she is not all right. It doesn't fit. It's not normal. It's not acceptable. When this happens, children are extremely flexible, and they cannot bear to be something that the family doesn't want, or that they are teased or humiliated or embarrassed or chastised or punished for. So they begin to pretend that whatever it is, it isn't true. They don't have that laugh. They aren't that tall. They're not interested in dolls or painting or singing or dancing or electronics or whatever it is that the whoever it was didn't approve of. And this pretense becomes so powerful that it turns into a denial. And so such children come into adulthood having forgotten that they are or have these things. And so you see tall children hunched down, pretending that they're not so tall. You see children who used to be able to laugh spontaneously, putting their hand over their mouth in order to suppress the laugh. You see children who started to dance or sing as infants, as toddlers, and no longer able to do that, and maybe even disparaging it. You see proclivities, interests, curiosities gone. Now, it is necessary to get through our childhood. But as you can perhaps see, coming into adulthood with less than who you are is limiting, to say the least. It's also unpleasant because we don't actually get rid of these things. They simply go undercover. So many of us come into adulthood demonstrating a cover story, something that is not the whole truth, but we learned early that if we had the whole truth exposed, it would be dangerous. And so we have whatever we had to put undercover, still undercover. Now, it's my belief, and it's the point of the Willen Show, that that does not have to be a life sentence, and that it is possible to recover some of what you had to hide in childhood. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and I do that because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the show I'm airing today with Carol Schweid demonstrates what it's like to be who you really are. Listen to how Carol evolves. Listen to the sweet story of her beginning life as a dancer. Listen to the courage to continue to become more and more and more what she is. And this is a delightful story. So here now is Carol Schweid. Okay, so I am here with Carol Schweid. And I am interviewing Carol at this time because she just published her first book.
Yay.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm explaining to Carol that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm.
And would you agree that the major art to which you have given your life and made a fair amount of your living is the art of theater?
I would say that's true.
Good. Okay. And I believe that you began with dance.
I did.
I only ask one question.
Oh.
And it is, can you tell me the very first time in your life that dance attracted you, interested you, seemed like something you wanted to do?
No, I can't.
Really?
No, because I can't remember a time when I didn't dance.
Ah.
I have a theory that, you know, if you're lucky and you're in the arts, you kind of get one thing as a gift. I do believe that you're sort of born a dancer.
Okay.
I mean, you can choose not to do it, of course.
Yes, right.
But ever since I can remember, I mean, really, I just danced.
Yeah.
And then started going to dance class and all that.
Did you ask for dance classes?
I do not know.
Oh, okay, fine. Do you remember when you started, or do you know?
I'm not sure exactly. I just know, and also my mom liked to dance.
Oh, did she?
We used to dance in the kitchen. She was always sort of happy when she was dancing, so we used to dance around the kitchen on occasion. At one point when I was older, we actually had dancing lessons for the family. We tried to teach my dad how to cha-cha and do the merengue and the foxtrot. We weren't all that successful, but it was my mom and my brother and me and my dad, and down in the basement, this fellow used to come and he would teach us lessons. We did this for maybe 6 weeks. It was great. There were places in New Jersey where you could go and have dinner and dance, believe it or not, and we used to do that. But the dancing, you know, who knows? I really don't know.
Well, when is the first time you remember a dance class? How old were you when you first remember?
Well,
were you 4? Were you 8? Were you 12?
Probably maybe 6 or 7, maybe younger even. Mm-hmm. You know, I have pictures of being in little recitals and things, and my mom used to get angry at the principal because he wouldn't let me out early so I could get to class on time. But then there was this great dancing school in South Orange, this woman, Emily Sarles, who may have been like a DeMille person. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but she was like a combo of ballet and modern, mm-hmm. which I've always loved. I loved that. So I started to take dancing class there. I would go there after school, mm-hmm. 8 or 9 maybe. And then when I was in junior high, our South Orange Junior High School was right up the street about a half a mile. So I would walk down from school mm-hmm. with my friend Nancy Hertz, and we would go to dancing class. But we would always stop at the Town Hall Deli, which was right next door. And the Town Hall Deli made these Sloppy Joes, which were not the normal Sloppy Joes people know about with the meat.
Yeah.
They were a special Jersey thing. There were like 3 slices of thin bread with these little squares of pastrami, and they were great, but they have to cut off the ends of the bread to make the sandwiches. We would stop in at the Town Hall Deli, and they'd give us the ends of the bread with butter.
You're kidding!
I am not kidding. We would go there all the time before dancing class, and then we would take the up with that and walk up the stairs, because it was exactly like the song. It was up a steep and very narrow stairway, and it was a big dance studio, and we would go in and take our ballet classes.
Always ballet?
I think eventually there was some jazz, maybe. I can explain it by saying that, like, when other people were sort of doing those awful things that people do at recitals, where they wear sparkles and these horrible routines, we were doing things like the dance on the beach from Carousel. That kind of music, that kind of theater dance, combo ballet modern.
Wow.
I know, I was very lucky.
Yeah.
It was different, and she was a good teacher. I remember one year, there was this great thing. I remember this because I have the record. Did you ever hear of a composer named Gordon Jenkins?
Of course.
Well, I don't know. There was something called Manhattan Tower, mm-hmm. and it was a story mm-hmm. about people in Manhattan. And it was like, Noah, where is Noah? I don't know. We had a dance to this that we made up, and it was like somebody was leaving New York, and somebody would go, leaving New York? Well, let me know, your New Yorkers got a rumor going around. There's some of you fine people want to leave this town. It was a dancing with stories. It's no accident that I used to know.
And not only that, but it's choreography now.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's not just dance, but it's choreography to a story, to an idea, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so now you're quite young, and you're already doing this. So is there a moment when you think, this is what I'm going to do with my life, or do you always know that, and so it's not a question?
I always knew this. There was no moment. Okay. I don't think there was. I mean, not that I remember that there was. I remember I just did it.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. Okay, so you go through high school.
I think I did it all through high school.
Okay, so then if you know that dance is going to be part of your life.
Yeah, well, I sort of liked the theater stuff, too.
Ah.
I had started going to somebody's acting class in New York. I went away when I was like 15 and went to a summer camp down in New Hope.
Yep.
It was a theater camp. And I think that's the first time I ever knew there was such an animal. I think it was the word. I went to 2 in high school. I was lucky enough to go to 2. I went to one was up in the Berkshires and one was in New Hope. The one in New Hope was some cute fellow named Lee. And we actually did like the Dream Ballet from Oklahoma or something out in the woods.
Oh.
You know, I got to have that experience. There was a dance teacher in New York named Luigi. He just died in the last 5 or 6 years, in his 80s. But he taught everybody. And he was teaching way back there in the 70s, whenever, and or the late 60s. And he came to the summer camp for a week. Mm-hmm. And it was all jazz. Luigi mm-hmm. was jazz. And he was a funny man because he had some issues where he wasn't supposed to be able to actually walk. That's because of something that happened. And yet, mm-hmm. here he was, dancing and teaching, and he sort of had one eye that went one direction and one the other. And he came and taught for, and we did these It was very jazzy, but very stretchy. Mm-hmm. We did that outside in the garden, and that was really fun. We did Luigi in the garden. I just thought that was the coolest thing. And Jose Limon also was there for part of the summer and taught modern.
Wow.
It was pretty amazing. And then another summer, the one up in the Berkshires, Debbie Jowett, who wrote for the Village Voice for 30 years about dance, taught at the summer camp and cast her little dance that she was doing choreography with five of us. And I had never been there before. I was the only newcomer, and I got cast.
Oh.
You know, because I was a good dancer.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had this thing for theater. I loved the theater. I loved the plays. I would go to New York and take a dance class at Luigi's. I would walk back to the Port Authority, find this bookstore. Used to be bookstores on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go in, and I'd read those modern library editions of plays. I'd sit on the floor, and I'd read plays.
Wow.
Until it was time to go walk to Port Authority and get on the bus.
Oh, my goodness.
Because reading plays, for me, was a lot easier than reading books.
Oh.
I had a really hard time with these books with all these words. So many words.
Oh, my God.
I remember reading Treasure Island and reading every word and not understanding one thing.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't, it wasn't like I couldn't read.
Yeah.
But it was harder. And the plays were so much better. When I discovered The Man Who Came to Dinner, it was like, oh, this is great. I understand what's going on every second. And I can see it in my head. And I get this. I like this. So it was always sort of a combo of liking.
So when you get, you're finishing high school.
Yes.
So what are you thinking about?
I wanted to study and become a better actor. I wanted to be an actor.
Ah.
I wanted to be an actress. I thought that would be interesting to study theater.
So what did you do?
So I went to Boston University as an acting major.
Uh-huh.
And I was a little clueless for a good long time. I took it all very literally.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me is you were not, unless I missed it, you were not particularly surrounded by people who wanted to go into the theater. You don't say anything about a drama class or a, you know.
Well, I think I started going to this drama class after meeting this cute guy in one of those summers.
Okay, so what is this? Like
so I followed him
sophomore to
his,
year or something
like that. So junior year or maybe it was senior, I would go on Saturdays to acting class to New York and we'd work on scenes and we'd sort of learn about acting.
Yeah.
It was really harder for me.
Yeah.
It was harder, but I found it really interesting. I loved it. I just didn't really...
You didn't feel
get,
like,
quite how to do it.
Yeah, it wasn't natural like that.
It wasn't natural like
right.
that. It really
okay.
wasn't.
Okay, so you say to yourself, well, I'm going to get better at this. I'm going to go to Boston and I'm going to study.
I'm going to study. And I did get better. I mean, I did get better. I worked on my audition pieces, and I got into a good college to study theater,
right.
which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I didn't get into Carnegie Tech. Of course, I had cheerled the night before, and I went to the audition with no voice. I went hoarse. I couldn't talk. That was pretty stupid of me.
Yeah.
I thought this was really important to yell loud.
Yes.
Anyway, so I go to BU, and some of the people in my class were already good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I was...
Yeah, they'd been doing it all their life, the way you'd been doing dance.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was getting to... I understood a whole lot more my second year. That was true. I got a lot of... But I also loved the history of the theater classes. We had a great professor who taught, you know, about the gladiators and the Romans. And they'd all be fighting, and then the gladiators that survived would be in the middle of the island, and everybody would cheer, and then the island would start to sing. But not so much. I don't know what it was.
You just love stories.
Yes. Maybe. Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe true. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Usually relatively short.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. And when I also loved the stage and shop crew.
Mm-hmm.
We were my first stage and shop. I was at front of the house crew, which means you're an usher.
Right.
And I loved that before the first performance, we all were sat down by the house manager, and she said, you know, you are the first people the audience meets when they walk in tonight. Think about that. You know, all of these things were really interesting.
Yeah.
My next job was I was on the prop crew, and I took care of a goat. It was a little less interesting, but I liked learning how to do lights. I liked all that stuff.
You like everything that has to do with
theater. I sort of do.
You do. You like everything.
I liked learning how to make a flat, because when you get a job as a counselor in the summer camp, you better be able to teach somebody in the art department how to build a flat.
Oh, wow.
And turn on a light.
Mm-hmm.
So I did 2 years at BU, and actually I did some summer stock. We did musicals in the summer.
So when did you start to sing, or that's just...
I did any singing in Boston.
Well,
but
musicals and summer stock? You were just dancing?
No, I was singing.
Yeah.
I was singing. I was singing harmony. I was singing the alto harmony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
I can still remember Amal Yankee Malchik, the alto part. And it was really great. Mm-hmm. I did have a great time, whatever those summers were. And then the second year at BU, I didn't get cast in something. I was taking a lot of things very literally, like when they said sense memory and you try to, you know, put your hands under a fire.
And I felt reached nothing. That right down.
I really
the
thought you had
my
to feel the sorrow. Exactly.
And I felt nothing.
Exactly. So I had this boyfriend in the summer, and his mother worked at Barnard. And her best friend was Martha Hill, who ran the dance department at Juilliard.
Ah.
You know, Boston was a lot of fun, but... there was something uneasy about it for me. I really just, I don't know. Whatever it was, I auditioned for the Juilliard Dance Department, and I got in.
Wow.
Exactly. I picked some jazzy thing, and I made up a dance, and I went, and I got in.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is a good choice for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was really serious about wanting a career, that I thought this would be my best suit.
Right.
So... then I called my parents and said, I'm changing colleges, folks. And it turns out this one gal, Lois Greenwald is her name, Lois Walden was her stage name, was also leaving BU. So we decided to be roommates.
Uh-huh.
We got a little apartment on 71st Street between Broadway and Amsterdam. And then all of a sudden I was at Juilliard. That was a very different story. That was dance, 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 dance. Study music, study music, study music. I lived with Lois for that first year, which was a little, it had its moments. And then I said, that's it for roommates. So I was walking up and down West End Avenue, and I saw this little woman sitting on the stairs, and I said, what are you doing? She said, well, I'm about to move out of this apartment. It's a big studio. And I said, can I see it? And she said, sure. And it was the big studio in a brownstone on West End Avenue. Remember that apartment?
I remember.
Great apartment. Mm-hmm. Big high ceilings, one room.
Right.
And my father said, no, my daughter's not living alone in New York City. And my mother, to her credit, came with me and co-signed the lease.
Wow. Yeah,
the rent was $100 a month.
My God.
Yes. And because I had done summer stock in Bushkill, Pennsylvania and Connecticut, Southington, Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
I had a few friends in show business world.
Yes.
Because at Juilliard, nobody really talked much. They were serious, and there was no drama department yet.
Right, right.
There was musicians, and they were all in their practice rooms.
Right.
And the dancers, you know, they don't eat.
Right.
They were dancing. They certainly didn't eat.
Right.
Lunch was a pack of Marlboros and a cup of coffee.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you couldn't eat. It was always like, Carol, you really should lose, you know, 10 pounds.
Yeah.
Carol, you really... So when I came in one day and fainted on the subway because I was taking diet pills, they thought that was just fine.
Oh, yeah.
It was not really particularly pleasant, but... I think I must have been really into it. I mean, I was taking ballet class every day and taking modern class every day. And I loved the Graham classes. It was her company who taught. That's mm-hmm. the beauty of Juilliard. Juilliard teachers are professionals working in the field.
Right.
That is why it's a great school. And you learn technique. Or you die.
Right.
And Fiorella Keene was a wonderful point teacher. She was she taught us how to kind of get up out of our feet in a way, and how to lift your body. You really, there's a lot to it. And
No kidding.
I did it. I got my bachelor's of fine arts in 3. I mean, it's not the most academic place I've ever been to. I think I enjoyed some of the classes. And of course, I wrote papers about vaudeville and Jerome Robbins and Agnes DeMille. And you know, that's how I got through college altogether,
right.
Writing about all this stuff. Which I loved, writing about it. And the dancing was great. I did love learning the Graham technique. I loved it. But I would leave school and go take singing lessons. I had a friend, this woman, Karen Jablons was her name, and she was my buddy. And she was going to Broadway
we knew we wanted to work mm-hmm. on Broadway, and we found a singing teacher, and we would go together, like down. We'd sneak out of school. They would not let me study sight singing because I was a dance major.
Oh, you're kidding!
I'm not kidding.
That's absurd.
I know, and I didn't know enough to fight for it.
Right.
You know, it was a pretty good experience. Mm-hmm. It wasn't terrible. There were things I would have done. I would have taken more point classes, more partnering point. I loved working on point, even though I knew I would never be a ballet dancer. But there was one man that taught partnering. And in one of the classes, the partnering was improvised. So you didn't really know what you and your partner. And that was so interesting. And like Lucas Hoving would come and teach, and he was different. And then I got graduated. I got out of there. I did well, I think. You know, I was a good dancer.
So you graduate.
I did.
And then what?
I went off to Flint, Michigan and did summer stock in a tent.
Uh-huh.
That was fun. And then I came back. Actually, that's how I got my first Broadway show.
How?
It's because Pat Birch, who was the choreographer, had been in the Graham Company. She was Graham dancer before she... And she must have taught some classes at Juilliard because I knew her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was auditioning for this show called Minnie's Boys. And she needed girls who could essentially dance like boys. She didn't need tall, 6 foot tall showgirls. She needed people like me,
right?
Who could really move and dance and turn and jump and all that
right.
stuff. So that was actually, we were in Mervyn's class together. When I went to my callback that night, and Mervyn put his arm around me and he said, go get the job. And if you don't get this one, we'll get you another one. He made me feel so great.
Yes.
And I went to the callback, and they eliminated people and limited, and there were like 6 of us or some left on the stage. And I remember Pat Birch and the director and the 3 of them, like a little triangle, moving from the front of the house to the stage in the aisle. And then they said, we would like to welcome all of you to the show. Running up the street, I think I saw somebody I knew, and I like jumped at him, and then I went to a phone booth and called my folks. I mean, it was, that's the biggest thrill, you know, ever. Mm-hmm. And then, at the end of it, this was not a hit, which is too bad, this is a show about the Marx Brothers,
right.
And Shelley Winters played the mother.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And at the end, there were 16 of us, guys and women, and we were all dressed up like different Marx Brothers at the very end. And at the very end of the show, we were like way in the back wall of the stage, and
right.
we walked towards the audience.
Right.
In our Marx Brothers outfit. So
right.
I was dressed like one, you know, there were like 4 Grouchos, 4 Harpos.
Yeah, right.
And it was at the Imperial Theater.
Uh-huh.
Where I had seen my very first Broadway show,
oh.
and also had been on the stage at the Imperial for the very first time, auditioning for a summer stock show. And we're walking down, and all of a sudden it hits me that I am walking on the stage of the Imperial Theater. Well, I started to cry. And I cried through the entire finale, and the entire curtain call, and the next 20 minutes down in the dressing room. It was kind of an emotional experience.
No kidding.
So that's my very first Broadway experience.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
It's wonderful.
It's a real accomplishment to get to do.
And you were so young.
I was pretty young, yeah.
What, were you 22?
23 something. 22, 23 something.
Right. And you were right out of the box. This is what everybody wants. That you decide on this thing, that you work on this thing, and then you get it. And you did.
I did?
Yes, you did. So you want to tell us what happened next?
Yeah, I want more! I think I was out of work for a year. You know, I don't really remember. I know I went to Bucks County for a year and did West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet and a million other things and choreographed stuff in the middle of the night for other theater companies.
There. Oh.
Whatever was going on, I was a part of it.
Right.
And it was nice to be in an acting company and work at a theater. A lot of years I came back, I did a lot of off-Broadway. I had a friend in an off-Broadway show, and somebody was leaving. She told the director about me, so I met him. And he asked me some questions, and then he said, oh, you're Jackie's friend. Oh, we'd love to have you in the show. So I've had referrals.
Yes.
From things. And in those days, you could go from one off-Broadway show that ran maybe 2 months. You get $100 a week. And then you go do another show for another 2 months, and then you do something else for another 2 months, and another 2 months.
You're a gypsy.
I was a gypsy.
Right.
And this was, some of these were plays, but most of them were musicals. Some of them had dancing, some of them didn't.
Yeah.
It was just whatever it was.
And you were in the biz.
I was in the biz.
Right.
And then eventually, I was in Fiddler on the Roof in a dinner theater in New Jersey. And in the chorus, one of the bottle dancers was Nick Dante, who was working on this little musical about dancers after the show at night with Michael Bennett. And he would bring in monologues occasionally and say, would you read this? And then somebody left the workshop of this thing that was rehearsing called the chorus line.
Right.
And Nick brought up my name and said, I'm working with a girl who's very good, Carol Schweid. And Michael went, Carol Schweid, she auditioned for me for a year and a half ago for something. I almost got the job, but didn't get it. I was called back and didn't get it. But he remembered me, and he said, oh, is she a dancer? Is she a dancer? So I came in, danced for 5 minutes, honestly, and I had the job.
Amazing.
And I went, oh, God, where have I just landed? Because I was then watching what they were doing. I went, oh, my God. Right. So that takes us up to chorus line.
Right.
Had a small part, then I went into a big part. And I got fired, and I went back briefly, then I, you know, it just got very difficult, as these enormous hits tend to do.
Right.
But it was a great place to be part of, you know. And eventually I did go out on the road and do Pippin for Bob Fosse, which was great, because I loved working for him, and I was a good dancer, and he appreciated that. And then it occurred to me that show business really is a job. They tell you it's a family, but it's not.
Right.
It's a job. And there I was out on the road with Pippin, playing this wonderful part, and I was so unhappy. I was so sad. I just felt like, am I ever going to get my life? I celebrated my 30th birthday in the laundromat, talking to somebody named John Kahn. Mm-hmm. I remember that because why would I make that up? So when I got home from the tour, which was over a year, this guy who had asked me out to lunch before I left, I decided to say yes. Well, we went to lunch, and then like 6 months later, we got married. And that took care of the next 20 years.
Right. Well, that's not true.
The boys.
And on the bench.
A little play that I wrote.
Yes, that's true.
Waiting for Godot in Riverside Park.
Right, exactly. And Agnes DeMille. That was a little play you wrote. Yeah, it was great. Both of them were great. Are you kidding?
Thank you.
No, you're a wonderful writer, and that's the other thing.
That's
but
true.
When you wrote on the bench, was that the first thing that you had written?
No, I did a little advertising, copywriting.
Mm-hmm.
There is some history as a youngster of stuff that I wrote. It's a long time ago, and I still have it somewhere. Some things that I wrote where I clearly wanted to write more.
Yes.
It sort of didn't fit with the person I thought I was, maybe. I'm not sure.
That's a really interesting thing, that you decided so early that you were a dancer. And that identity was so powerful, so that even while it was clear from the beginning that stories were passionately attractive to you, and that's all writers are, people who love, words and stories, I mean, really, somehow you didn't allow that to interrupt the earlier identification. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I remember having conversations with you talking about what a wonderful writer you were and telling me that you weren't. But you are, I think now that you're saying that you always were.
I don't know. I know when I really get a fire lit under my thoughts, I can communicate something pretty significantly well.
Yes.
I'm aware of that.
Yes.
You know, I'm a slow writer. It takes me a while to figure out. I write, but yes. When I have something to say, I can sometimes say it well.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
We'll take that.
Okay, good.
Okay, so then you have your children.
I have these two adorable boys, Max and Dan. They're adorable, yes.
And you raise your children.
And we moved to Connecticut.
Where you promptly become part of everything.
That's why I moved here.
Right.
Because I heard there was a theater group. I heard there were a lot of... We're out in New York, so there's a lot of show folk.
Right.
This town has a history of supporting the writers, the advertising guys, a lot of them lived here in the 50s and the 60s. This is and the Westport Playhouse, and Paul Newman lived here.
Right. And professional
actors, writers, directors, all of that.
Yeah. Okay, so you become part of the Westport.
Right. All of this. I'm on the arts committee, I'm on the cultural arts committee, doing this and that. And then I'm sitting in a meeting one day with these cultural arts where we bring stuff into the schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm already a member of the Theater Artists Workshop, which is another group that's professional folks. And I'm sitting in the back of the room with my friend Nancy. And we're starting to be bad kids in the back of the room, going, we got to get out of here. We got to do something else.
Yeah.
So we start to think, what can we do? What can we do? Let's do something that has things we like theater and food.
Mm-hmm.
Theater and food. Let's put them together and see what happens. So we come up with this idea, and I think I came up with the title, but I couldn't swear to it. And we decided we're going to do theater at lunchtime, and we're going to call it Play With Your Food. And give people lunch, and then we're going to show them plays. One-act plays. And we're not going to have them memorize. We're going to do them as stage readings.
Yeah.
Because who can afford to hire actors to learn parts?
Right.
Nobody wants to memorize anything anyway. We're all too lazy. I mean, we don't know how anymore. You can't really learn the way the olden days they did.
Well, and for this, you didn't need to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we started this in 2003, amazingly enough. And we've been doing that ever since. For a long time.
For a long time.
For a long time.
So, and it expanded, and it expanded, and it expanded.
Yeah, we started one show a month in Westport, and then we went to two, then we went to three, I think, because at a time, in a row. Then we went to Fairfield, and then we went to Greenwich, or went to Stanford. I don't know. We started expanding into different towns, and we'd find new restaurants and do the lunch, and then we'd do the plays. And we kept it very short, very tight. Starts at noon, ends at 1:30. After the plays, we do talkbacks a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then people go back to their lives at 1:30, having had a fulfilling adventure.
Absolutely. For which you pick the plays, you hire the actors, you rehearse them, and you ran the talkback.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, that's pretty much it.
And
I would find the plays, and we'd both read them. And then we'd have other people sometimes read them also and see what they thought and get input and stuff. And I would get the royalties, too. I forgot that part. Mm-hmm. I'd pay the royalties, too. And I'd also take care of the books. But Nancy would do the restaurants. She'd do the PR.
Tickets.
She'd do the tickets. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so Nancy took a step back. And then this great gal, Inga Mackey. I think it was Inga came in because she's been with me like 6 years now. And she's... You know, she's a smart gal, she's a lawyer, she's very good at dealing with people, and so she took on that, and Nancy worked with her and got her kind of, and then Nancy really wanted to step back another step. So, and also Inga has a great feel for plays, she's with people, and she's a little younger, so she knows what the hot restaurants are.
Aha.
She knows what's hot,
because
she has still had kids in school.
Ah.
And then this great gal named Diana Mahler also came to me and said, you know, I've been in your audience for a bunch of years, and I'm dying to go back to work, and I really think I could. And she loves theater.
Oh.
She's a theater hound.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows plays, and she knows. So she then became our producer, essentially.
Wow.
So she does, like, the e-blast and the stuff, and does all the producer stuff. I don't even know what half of it is anymore, because I don't have to pay attention. And then we all read plays, and we go to plays, and we find actors, and we do plays, and da da da. We're like, we do this whole
thing. Yeah, yes, wonderful.
And we keep finding new stuff, hopefully, and sometimes we do an old piece here and there, because who remembers from
2003?
You know, right,
right.
Exactly. And then, because I thought this was so terribly, terribly interesting, the stage reading part of it, I started putting my thoughts to paper, and thinking, why did I pick that play? Well, this is why.
Huh. I wrote a blog for a while. Yeah, that's where it actually came from.
Ah.
I wrote a blog, and I would write not so much about stage readings, but about my job.
Yes.
Like, I wrote one where it was either spring or fall, and I discovered that I was outside a lot, walking here and there to the library, say, or to the... And I'd be carrying books of plays. And it was a sense of, I have the best job in town, because I get to walk on people's lawns and go to and sit around and read plays. So it was how I like sitting around outside.
Yeah, this is like what you did when you were in school, and you would go to the bookstore.
Yeah,
right. That's right.
That's exactly right. Changing up my environment.
Yeah, right. But the
the
context, the activity is the same, right?
Right. Yeah. Oh, I didn't even thought of that. Yeah. That's good. So I would read plays, and then I'd write a blog, and then something would occur to me, or I was involved in some event, like, because there's always chorus line events. Because when you're a member of an original cast of a show like that, that makes a mark, a real mark. There's always anniversaries, parties. there was an event, well, when they did the revival, I was invited, we were all invited back, and it was a big deal, because it was a big hit. So that was a lot of fun. And then when Hamilton did an event for, it was the 40th anniversary of the first performance of A Chorus Line.
Wow.
And we were all invited to see it, and then to a party and meet the cast, and up on stage and stuff. And it was all refilmed. So this was on the news.
Wow.
So this became a big deal, and another thing where people in town could see, oh yeah, she wasn't kidding. She was really in that. Oh, oh.
Yeah, right.
So that was always fun.
Yeah, your credibility.
Yeah.
Right?
It always goes up.
Right, and your visibility. Right.
Huge.
Right, and that has an impact on whatever it is you're doing, like play with your food.
Exactly, and ticket sales and all that stuff. Because it's fun to be part of something like that.
Yes.
So I would write about stuff like that, or what that felt like, or what it felt like to hang out with Marvin Hamlisch. Or, you know, it was always interesting and fun to write. And then I sort of ran out of things to write about, because I'm not that interesting on the blog. And then I guess I did get the idea of, boy, other people might want to know about this. So I started jotting down notes, and then I started
writing.
Okay,
but you better say what this is.
Well, I had this idea that about writing a book about staged readings, which is what we do at Play With Your Food. We don't hire people to learn their lines and to, you know, rehearse for 2 weeks. We hire actors for a couple of hours. I think our contract says we get them for, you know, a couple of hours a day to do the show, and then we have a certain number of hours we can rehearse, which we never use because, I don't know, we just don't. We sit around. I don't know, I just started writing down what I stuff that I learned, and then I started to take a and then I thought, oh well, this would be fun to have a dozen plays in this book, and then each play would have a chapter on a different topic of staged readings, like how do you pick a play, and then I'd have a play that I picked and tell why.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a little forced, but I sort of worked at it anyway. I think what happened really was about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a little tour across the country visiting friends, and went out to LA to visit Max, my oldest son, who graduated from college. And I stayed in Holly's extra room and was there for a month. And that was a great room to work in. And then I went up to San Francisco. I didn't work up there much, but then I ended up in Ashland, Oregon, which is the Shakespeare Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, a friend of a friend, had a friend whose parents had an extra house up the road from their house.
Wow.
And they said, sure, you can stay at the house. Fine. So there was this house. And there was very little around it. I mean, Ashland was like a 5-minute drive or a 10-minute drive. But I spent a lot of time up there. It was kind of in the woods. And I think I found the structure for the book there. Because there's one thing in the book where there's two actors who are very accomplished, worked on Broadway, and they do Play With Your Food often because they like the challenge. So I wrote them a note and I said, would you be able to maybe write me a couple of paragraphs on how you approach a staged reading? And a couple of weeks later or days later, I got something back from both of them. And it was interesting to read because they're very different, and yet they were wonderful. And I thought, ooh. And then all of a sudden it felt more public. Maybe that's what it was. I started to engage other people. And I kept... And then, oh, I know what happened. That summer in Oregon, this is actually the last paragraph of the introduction to the book. The summer I was there, something happened to a cracked support beam in one of the theaters. The support beam cracked, and they could not do a show there. So they had to relocate two of the shows, Osage County and To Kill a Mockingbird, into Town Hall down the street. But they couldn't move costumes, scenery, sets, nothing. All they had were the actors.
Wow.
That's exactly right. And the way it was done was it was 24 hours notice.
Wow.
So all they did, the stage manager introduced the play. He said, okay, this is when they go like this, they're going to be upstairs. You know, he explained what was happening, but you never saw it. And then they did the play. The acting was amazing. And everybody loved them.
Yeah.
And the truth is, they were incredibly relieved that this went over so well. Everybody was relieved and surprised.
Right.
But not me. Because I see it all the time.
Right.
So it was a reinforcement of... what I know to be true is, essentially. These things can really be really good and really memorable. They don't have to be people sitting on stools in front of music stands with bottles of water at their feet, which is fine, but there's lots of other ways to do them. So I started to think about how we've done them and how certain things we would stage them, but if you stage it too much, that's not good. You have to, it's a staged reading, but you have to not overload it. You have to find what's right for each play.
Wow.
Then I started to think, how do I approach each? So some of the plays actually, some of the things in the book, I actually talk about how we staged a couple of these plays, which are not in the book. So right. If you want to know the play, you got to either download it or find it. But it's really a book of... I've had a lot of great teachers in my life, so it was sort of great to channel, like, plays written in the 1990s are different than a play written in the 1970s or the 1950s, which is, or the, you know, the swinging 60s. And there are, there's writing about this. There's information about this. Stella Adler wrote a fabulous book about context. Mm-hmm. What, you know, if it's 1970s and everybody's a little stoned, everybody's a little high, that's a whole different feeling mm-hmm. than if you're doing a play about corporate America and everybody's like this. It's all about asking the right questions, understanding the play, casting it in a way like I think it's a little bit like being a manager of a baseball team. If you have a play that's funny, you have to have people who know how to have a sense of timing, who know how to get a laugh.
Right.
If the play is in verse, you better have people who can do language. The same way that if you're playing against a hot baseball team with heavy hitters, you got to have a good outfield.
Yeah.
So you just have to think about this stuff, and then follow through on your thoughts. If you have a we have one play that Dinner with Friends that I happen to love. The first scene of this play, it takes place in a very upscale kitchen. Well, I think that would be stupid, seeing people sitting around in regular chairs. Mm-hmm. But I found this table that's 4 feet high and like about 3 feet long and narrow. And if you put three stools behind it, it looks like a kitchen. And then the actors can lean on it.
Right.
And their scripts can be on it, or they can move around it. So it creates sort of stage behavior.
Yes.
The furniture creates the behavior,
yes,
in a sense, because right. It's just right on.
Right.
So it's really, so it's a book of ideas. These are my ideas. These are things that I've noticed other people have done. And then this is what we did at Play With Your Food. And hopefully all of these ideas, out of these 85 pages, will trigger your own ideas. You know, Albert Haig, he'd say things that would stay with you. Like, it's a very democratic world. Everybody has the same 24 hours. And he meant it.
Yeah.
He would say, you know, when he was a young composer, he would practice the piano. And he'd imagine putting $5 into a piggy bank every hour. So that he was investing in his gift. That was the way. He would say there's no monopoly on creative thinking. You just have to figure out how to point yourself in the right direction, maybe. And, you know, I don't know, and see what happens. But you want to stack the deck in your favor. This is show business. You got to...
And essentially your book is stacking the deck.
In a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way. And it's also, you want to do a full-length play and you have 3 hours to rehearse, or two.
Right.
What do you do? Mm-hmm. Do you read it together and then go on stage? Or do you read it and talk about it?
Yeah.
Do you pull out what's important in it, or what you think is important in it? And it's just about that.
Well, no, it's not just about that. It seems to me that it is about, first of all, presenting the fact that stage readings can be, in and of themselves, compelling and satisfying.
Yeah.
And then encouraging other people to do what you did, which is discover your own approach to this.
Yeah.
What looks good to you on stage, right?
Right. Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And if you acknowledge the fact that everybody's looking at the stage.
Right.
Why not have that work in your favor?
Yeah.
That's really the nib. And also, very basic stuff like making sure there's enough light,
mm-hmm.
making sure people can be heard.
Yeah.
You forget.
Yeah.
Making sure the pages are numbered. People drop things.
Right.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. And then, of course, there's a whole thing about, you know, older actors, a lot in a way, who are incredibly gifted, but who wants to sit around for a month and a half and learn, you know, it's a way of doing really good theater.
And using talent, which is available and not all that well used.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And these are, you know, you can do a stage reading on and you don't have to plan it months in advance.
Right.
If you have some brilliant idea, or, you know, we've also done events. We've done parties. We've done anniversary parties.
Yes, and you should know that if you have an organization that is having an event, you might want to use Play With Your Food.
Well, why not?
Why not is exactly right.
Exactly.
And you should say right here and now how they contact you.
Okay, well, we are a not-for-profit, a 501c3, and the company that owns, that runs this is JIB Productions, Inc., or Inc., right. And the website is jibproductions.org.
Good.
So that's how you find
us. Yeah, in case...
Or you could Google Play With Your Food.
Could somebody hire you to come and speak about this?
Absolutely.
Or consult?
I've done that, actually, a few times already.
Okay, so how would they reach you?
Well, probably through our website.
Fine.
Send me an email through the info@JIB. I'll get it. I think that's probably the best way to find me. Let me tell you one more thing.
Oh, yeah.
There's a group, Child Advocates of Connecticut, where they had a party, and then we were the entertainment. We were the after-dinner speaker.
Oh, wow.
So we put on a few plays about parents and children.
Wow.
And it was wonderful.
I'm sure it was wonderful.
It was really wonderful.
And different.
And
people are not having exactly the experience they have always had, right?
And it opens the world up to wonderful conversations. Yeah. It's a great icebreaker. And, you know, we have some incredibly funny stuff that's a little raunchy, or we have a little more serious stuff that's for the straighter audiences. You know, you fit the thing to the thing.
So this is the last question I have. Having spent a life essentially involved in, dedicated to theater, is there anything you would say about what that's like or what you think about it?
Oh, yeah, I guess. Gee. I'm pretty proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I was able to do it for the most part. It's work. You have to keep your foot on the gas all the time because it's hard to always make a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easier now, but it's hard to, you're always looking for your next job.
Yes.
But sometimes I wish I wasn't quite so opinionated about things. Like, I would fight about stuff that maybe I wasn't always right about. And also, I would have included more people. I wouldn't have been so lone wolfish.
Yeah.
You didn't really ask me that, but I'm answering it anyway.
Yeah, it's all right.
I love the people.
Mm-hmm.
I always love the people. I love the people that I work with, and that's the fun part.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been great. It's really been great.
The other thing that's true about you is that you have evolved. You started with this, I'm a dancer, that's all, right? Then maybe I'm an actor, maybe, right? But you just kept evolving so that now, in addition to being a dancer and an actor and a singer, and playwright, you're an author. You're an author.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, right. And I think that's inspiring. I really do.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I have to say, I think it's pretty amazing. I do. I think it's remarkable. And I look at the book, and I look at the spine of the book, and I see the little S&K for Smith and Krause. And my bookshelf is lined with books from Smith and Krause. I admire that company and what they do.
That's who published your book.
Yes, and I just kind of can't get over it. I just can't get over it. I look at it and I walk on the other side of the room and I turn around.
Oh, you know what? Didn't say the name of the book.
The name of the book.
Right.
That is so funny. That's so funny. It's called Staged Reading Magic.
Yay!
By Carol Schweid.
Woo!
Okay.
And you can get it at Amazon.
Yes, you can. Yeah. Or at Smith & Krause, I think.
Right. Right.
Well, thank you, Lynn. This
You're
has been
very
amazing.
Welcome. Thank you, Carol. So, as I said in the opening, it is my hope that when you listen to people like Carol, you are inspired to ask yourself, am I living the life that I was meant to live? Am I proud of myself? When something called me, when something seemed interesting, curious, delightful to me, did I reach for it? Did I go for it? Did I take the risks that Carol took? Did I take the leaps? When you listen to Carol, you can hear what it sounds like to be open to being yourself. It's not always easy. It's not always what others might think is correct for you. But it is my belief that the happiest people are those who say yes to themselves, like Carol. So, again, if you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelinshow.com. As always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use, something that piqued your curiosity, something that inspired you, something that will get you to buy Carol's book, Staged Readings, something that will get you to go out to the theater, but mostly something that will make you ask yourself, am I being all that I can be? Something that will bring you back, because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So